No taxation without representation. 200 years of exploitation in the capital of this nation. No representation in the capital of this nation. 200 years of exploitation. Give the people their right to vote. Someone asked me, was it true? The voting rights of the district were long overdue.
That was Sweet Honey in the Rock with Give the People Their Right to Vote. Hello and welcome to Shadow Politics, an hour-long grassroots talk show, which will attempt to shine a light on the issues that you care about. I'm your host, United States Senator Michael D. Brown, coming to you live from the District of Columbia, America's last colony. I hope my show will start a dialogue with America about the issues that are important to you and affect the lives of all of us. Normally, you would be able to call in, but this is a pre-recorded show, so unfortunately today you can't. But we have a very, very, very special guest with us today. We have Representative Dan Goldman, who's the congressman from New York's 10th District. Representative Goldman, before he ran for office, served as the counsel in the first impeachment of former President Donald Trump and as assistant United States attorney in the Southern District for New York. He has written about and provided expert analysis on significant topics ranging from criminal justice reform to special counsel's investigation. In law school, he contributed to a Michelle Alexander's seminal book, The New Jim Crow, which addresses inequities in our criminal justice system. And it's so exciting to have him here with me today. Thank you so much, Congressman, for being on.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Great to be with you.
Well, let me tell you, first of all, I'm very appreciative because I know you guys just passed a continuing resolution and that there's a lot going on right now, and you're running for reelection, as all congressmen have to do every 2 years. So let me ask you, this is my first question. I have to ask this to every member of Congress. My personal opinion is that the efficiency of Congress would be increased considerably if we would change congressional terms in the House of Representatives to 4 years from 2 years. What do you think of that idea? You think we should go to 4 years for a representative?
Yeah, look, I like that idea. I certainly don't like having to run every 2 years because it basically means that you are permanently running. That obviously was not the case when the founders wrote the Constitution and created the two-year term limits. I can also understand, though, wanting to make sure that you are close to the people and that there is at least one body that is more responsive to the people. You know, in an ideal world, I would probably say 3 years makes the most sense, but then you get odd-year elections, which presents a whole other complicated problem. But it is, it's not good for our system that these elections come every 2 years and campaigns are essentially just constant.
And am I wrong about this, or would we have to amend the Constitution to make that happen?
We would
have to amend the Constitution. But you think that it would breeze through the House of Representatives, and that I guess it would get a little pushback in the Senate. First thing I learned in politics is there's always somebody that's against everything, no matter what you're in favor of. There's always opposition. Well, yeah, I think it'd be a good idea too. But let's move on to something that I know is near and dear to your heart, and you're working on hard, and that's closing the bump stock loophole act of 2023. Why is this important, Congressman?
Well,
I think y'all know why it's important, but you tell us what you think.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think it's in many ways it's self-explanatory, but I'm grateful that you're bringing attention to it. As many will remember from the Las Vegas mass shooting in 2017 that killed 58 people at the concert, The reason why the deaths were so high is that the shooter was using what's called a bump stock, which basically turns a semi-automatic rifle into an automatic rifle that just continuously fires while you hold it down once. You don't have to reload or even re-trigger. And there's no legitimate reason for any civilian, you could even make an argument for any for the military, but that's a separate issue, but certainly for any civilian to turn a semi-automatic weapon into an automatic weapon. Certainly you're not using that for hunting or self-defense or other issues. It becomes a weapon of war on our streets. And so what this bill would do is it would make it illegal to manufacture, sell, or possess bump stocks for civilian use, and try to slowly but persistently narrow the deadliness of our gun violence epidemic and reduce the number of deaths from during mass shootings, which almost always use semi-automatic or automatic weapons.
I understand there are 195 co-sponsors of this bill, but what I don't understand is why there are not 435 co-sponsors of the bill. I read that 8 in 10 people surveyed are in favor of banning bump stocks. So why aren't more... Why don't we have more members of Congress on the side of getting this done? Is it because of the gun lobby?
Well, you've raised perhaps the most perplexing conundrum that I've faced in Congress in my first 2 years, which is that ordinarily elected officials are responsive to their constituents and their voters. It doesn't mean that if it's 51-49 that they're always going to go with the 51, but for the most part, we are supposed to be representing our constituents and the American people. There is no other policy issue where you see so many bills that are served by 80%, 75%, even more of Americans than basic gun safety legislation, including this bump stock loophole, including universal background checks, including red flag laws, including safe storage, just common sense legislation that makes sure that competent and qualified people are the only ones who own guns and that they are protected and used safely and appropriately. And yet, no Republicans will move forward with this very, very favorable legislation and preferred legislation. And the only reason is because the Republicans continue to be beholden to the gun lobby, to their special interests, and they use this as a wedge issue for political purposes where they misrepresent what these bills are designed to do and try to use it for political purposes in a very misleading and deceptive way, all while catering to the gun industry.
Well, you know, I grew up around guns. I think many Americans, especially my age, grew up around guns. We've always had guns in America. But this stuff is crazy. It's crazy to have automatic. I mean, what possible... Right? What possible civilian use, as you've already pointed out, could this have? And I don't understand. Do you think the media is, for some reason, is too timid on this particular issue as well? You know, former President Trump there's been two attempts on his life. In both cases, they were AR-15 style rifles, but nobody's talking about that. All these guys that are out there on the Republican side saying, yeah, you know, everybody in America should have any gun they want. They refuse to address these issues. And when we have so many Americans in that are tired of these mass shootings. You know, I know I'm preaching to the choir here, Congressman, but when I was growing up, I'm 71 years old, we didn't have any mass shootings that we heard of anyway. I mean, there was one from a college in Texas where a shooter got up in a bell tower. But other than that, we didn't have this. Now we have them every day. Every day we have them. It's just
almost 2 a day. It's terrible, and it's a copycat issue, as you point out. And there's the real frustration is that something can be done. We know what to do in order to reduce mass shootings, in order to protect our children. And the most shocking statistic is that gun violence is now the leading cause of death of children in our country. Cars have gotten safer, and guns have not. And the fact that our numbers continue to go up and up and up, and in every other country in the world they don't, they're going down, shows you that this is not a mental health issue. Certainly there's mental health aspects to it, but that's not what causes all of these mass shootings. It is our gun laws, our very permissive gun laws, that allow for these mass shootings to happen and allow for parents like me to worry when their child, like my son did yesterday, has a active shooter drill in second grade.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I know you're a parent, Congressman. I read that you have 5 children. You should have come and talked to me. You should never let the children outnumber the parents. That's a big mistake. You know, my three children formed a gang with my wife, and they've worked against me for many, many years. But yeah, it really is a concern, right? My wife's a teacher, so I have the same concern you are. She's a school librarian, and I know for a fact if there was a shooter in her school, my wife wouldn't hesitate to put herself in between her and a child. And I know that most teachers would do that. So I worry about her every day she goes to school. And it's just crazy. We shouldn't. You know, we see in this latest incident of where the shooter, where a student shot several students, and there were 2 police officers in the school. That's how, again, with an semi-automatic handgun, by the time they could get to him, you know, and that's what my wife tells me about her school, too. She has a resource officer, but the school's gigantic. He can't be everywhere at one time. So, yeah, it's crazy. We need to do something about this. And we know that the gun laws all across America are crazy. Are they not? In the Uvalde incident, for example, this really stuck with me, that kid had an AR-15 style rifle because he was too young to buy a handgun. What kind of law is that, where you're too young to buy a handgun but you're not too young to buy an assault rifle? I mean, that's just insane. And thank God that there are people like you, Congressman, who are there standing up for all of us that are happy to have people have guns. You know, we believe in gun ownership if that's what people want, but we just want reasonable, sensible, reliable gun laws. Before we move on to talk about anything else, is there anything? Oh, you know what else I want to ask you? I want to ask you, should we hold gun manufacturers responsible? You know, shouldn't we do that? I mean, I don't understand why I have to have a license, registration, and insurance on my car because it's potentially dangerous, but I don't have to have any of that on a firearm.
That's a very good point. And the problem that we have in terms of holding manufacturers liable is a 2005, I believe it was, 2004, 2005 law that the George W. Bush administration passed that gave immunity to gun manufacturers for any civil liability that may arise from guns that they manufacture, sell, or distribute. That has protected them on a federal level. On the state level, that doesn't exist, which is part of the reason why the Sandy Hook families were able to sue under state law
And there's actually a lawsuit from Mexico right now that's working its way up the courts that is arguing that because it's an international issue, it's exempt. But that's a huge obstacle to making these manufacturers and distributors liable for all of the deaths that occur if they are responsible for guns ending up in the wrong hands. And certainly there would be much better policies and procedures and controls and guardrails if they would be financially on the hook. So this is also something that, you know, we're focused on in Congress, but again, we just have no cooperation from the Republican side.
Yeah, that's really terrible. Can we talk for a minute about what you guys have been struggling over for the last few days? You've passed a continuing resolution. One thing I wanted to talk to you about was bipartisanship. How do we get bipartisanship back in Congress? You've just passed a continuing resolution. Lots of Republicans against it, against passing a funding bill. What's that about? Don't we need to? I mean, we've got a continuing resolution till when, Congressman? Till the end of the year?
Till December 20th. Every single Democrat supported it, all 209, and there were more than 80 Republicans who were opposed to it. So once again, the Democrats took the lead in making sure that our government is open and functioning, which is the bare minimum that Congress has to do. And it has been an incredibly ineffective and inept Congress led by the Republican majority that has really gotten nothing of any substance done.
You know, and this is certainly an issue that we track carefully here in D.C. because it affects federal workers, but it also used to shut down the District of Columbia. Luckily, I know you know all this because you sit on the committee that oversees a lot of what happens in the district. But a few years ago, Eleanor Holmes Norton, our delegate to Congress, was able to get a law passed that we didn't have to shut down when the federal government shut down. But in the past, we used to have to shut down when the federal government shut down. So we're very concerned about this, and it really makes us look silly, doesn't it? Doesn't it make the Congress look inept that we can't get this done?
Yeah, I mean, the fact that there are so many Republicans who would be happy to have a government shutdown, I think tells you a lot about the problems we have with bipartisanship, is that there are a large number of extreme Republicans who go to Congress not to govern well, not to implement good policy, but basically to undermine the government process. And it's a little odd for me that you would want to be part of an institution that you are trying to destroy, but that is effectively what is happening with some of these extreme far-right Republicans, and there are more and more now in the Republican Party, and they have more and more power and more influence, which is why, even though there are a lot of bipartisan bills that get through committees, they don't reach the House floor, because these extreme Republicans view bipartisanship as a four-letter word, and the Speaker only has so much capital to use for bipartisan legislation, and he needs to save it for keeping the government open, as one example.
Well, you know, it seems to me that we're moving more and more in the direction when I look at campaign. You know, we don't get as many campaign ads here as they do in other places of the country, because D.C. always votes for the Democrats. But what I've seen from what's going on in Maryland and Virginia, we talk a lot about the opposition party rather than the candidate. You know what I mean? Like there's Angela Ossoff Brooks, for example, is running ads now in Maryland talking about how if Larry Hogan wins, that's her Republican opponent. If Larry Hogan wins, then the Republicans can take control of the Senate. and we don't want that. And that's true. I mean, there's nothing wrong about that in the sense that it's factual. But I wonder, shouldn't we be talking about the candidate and not so much, you know, what party controls what? I wonder about that.
I would love for us.
More in that direction. Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, I would love for us to get back to that point. And I think I always use the example of George W. Bush, whose policies I really disagreed with. But I never questioned whether he cared about this country or whether what he was doing was what he believed to be in the best interest of this country. And with Donald Trump now and all of these followers of his who view the government and elected service as a personal ambition, as for their own personal interest, it's very hard to have these policy discussions when the very basis of our democracy is under attack. And so, yes, I would love to get back to that. But the reality is, first of all, Donald Trump's entire campaign is predicated on fear, division, and hate. He's not talking about anything that he would do in a positive way to make anyone's lives better. All he is talking about deceptively and disingenuously and I think misleadingly, is how awful it will be if Kamala Harris wins the election. And in return, what we are seeing is the Republican Party with a stacked Supreme Court that's taking away people's rights, that's taking away people's freedoms. And so the problem is that that's a more powerful message to people than trying to explain why my affordable housing policy will actually benefit, you know, more Americans than the other person's housing policy. And that's just a more detailed, nuanced conversation that fewer people are interested in having.
Yeah, and it's, you know, it's really one of the oldest canards in politics, right? It's I can't remember, maybe it was Al Capone who said it's better to be feared than loved, but fear mongering politics goes way back. It seems to me, though, it's getting worse and worse. I remember in a time, Congressman, I worked for the Democratic National Committee. I was a political consultant for 25. I've worked in Democratic politics for 45 years, and I remember a time when Ted Kennedy and Bob Dole were friends, you know, and used to have breakfast together regularly. Do we need to do things like that? Do we need to, should we start an organization that comes up there and has, you know, social events for Republicans and Democrats so they can get to know each other better? You think that would help at all?
I do think it helps, which is part of the reason why I started the Congressional Bagel Caucus, where I bring down the very best of bagels in the world from my district in New York and invite Democrats and Republicans to come break bread and just hang out, because I do think that that is important. And there are lots of other ways that members can do that, although I think it happens a lot less frequently. But even under the current circumstances, I think personally, I get along pretty well with most of my Republican counterparts, even though I vehemently disagree with them on a lot of things. The problem is that there are a few, more and more in the Republican Party now, who just aren't interested in legislating. They're not interested in governing. They're not interested in bipartisanship. They're there to grandstand. They're there for their own brand. They're there for their own ambition, and they don't really care if nothing gets done.
Well, and I've got to say that I know there's good food all around the world, but I was raised in metropolitan New York, and there's nothing like a New York bagel. I will fight that fight with anybody. But yeah, I think we need to do more of that. And you're right. We all can relate on I think it's right when people say we have more in common than what separates us, like our candidate Kamala Harris is saying. You know, right? We all love our children. I think we all love America too. I mean, I don't think there's that much dissension in the way we feel about our democracy and our system of government. But we get down these little rabbit holes and we get sucked into these little, you know, arguments that really balloon up into more than they should be, I think. Since we're talking about Donald Trump, let me just ask you. I mean, I can't have you on the show. You were the lead counsel for the first impeachment trial. I don't want you to go into the specifics of the case, a congressman or anything you're not comfortable with. But what can you tell us from your experience? What does this tell us about this man that's running for re-election as president of the United States? What can we learn from what you observed about Donald Trump that maybe we don't already know?
I think it's encapsulated by one of the arguments that his lawyer made during the Senate trial of the first impeachment on the Senate floor, where they basically made the argument that if Donald Trump believes that something is in his personal interest, it is therefore also in the national interest, which is just so fundamentally contrary to our basic rule of law and the notions that no one is above the law in this country. But that is the way Donald Trump thinks. He views everything from a completely self-oriented, selfish lens, and all he cares about is himself, and every decision he makes, the only consideration is how it will impact himself. And you can't have a leader of a democracy, a leader of a powerful country like this, who is making decisions for our nation based on what benefits him the most. And that was something that we saw in that first impeachment on Ukraine, when he tried to extort the president of Ukraine to open up an investigation. His political rival, Joe Biden, that was a bogus investigation, just so that he could use it for his political advantage. And he withheld $400 million of military assistance that was already appropriated and was required to be sent to Ukraine. And he did that because he wanted him to do him a favor, as he said, a personal favor. And so that is who Donald Trump is at the core, and that is literally what everything that has followed from the 2020 election effort to overturn the election to January 6th to his belief that he's simply above the law, and that, you know, if the election is bogus, if he doesn't win, it's good if he does win, but it's bad if he doesn't win. And classified documents that are his because he's the president, and therefore he gets to take whatever he wants. You know, this is just Donald Trump essentially pushing the envelope of our rule of law to the point of no return, where it's just whatever he wants, whatever he believes, that is allowed, and anything else would not be allowed, that he's exempted from the law. And that's a very scary thing as it has unfolded, and as his grievances have increased, his desire for revenge has increased, his frustration with the guardrails of democracy has increased. And what we are looking at right now in a future Donald Trump presidency is actually written out for all to see in Project 2025. And it is incredibly, incredibly scary, and it will get rid of the democracy as we know it if he is elected.
Yeah, and make no mistake about it. I know that there are people out there that think that, you know, that are buying this nonsense that he didn't have anything to do with this and he has no understanding of it. But the truth of the matter is, I used to work at a public interest group next to the Heritage Foundation. They were one of our big foes. And I can tell you that all those people that were involved in this report will be involved in a new administration if he gets elected. So you're absolutely right. But let me ask you something that really, really struck me. I listened to J.D. Vance the other day on TV talk about how they had made up this nonsense about dogs and cats in Springfield, Ohio, to bring attention to what was going on in Springfield, Ohio. And I thought about it and I said, yeah, I bet they did do that. But not to help the people of Springfield, Ohio, but rather to hold up Springfield, Ohio as substantiation for their narrative that the country is going to hell in a handbasket, right? That immigrants are causing all these problems. And even though it's not true, even though we know from information we're getting there that nobody's eating dogs and cats, that these guys are responsible citizens. They're not causing crime at any higher rate than people, you know, are indigenous species or indigenous people. So do you think he's crazy or is he just brilliant? Is this a brilliant campaign move to bring them up and make them front and center? And I bring this up, Congressman, because I believe they try to do it with the District of Columbia all the time, too. We just had a crime bill that was rejected on Capitol Hill. And that's what they, and that was the I think the impetus behind them standing up to the crime bill is they want to make D.C. look horrible as well to support their narrative. So is he brilliant or is he crazy or is he both?
Well, in your opinion? It's incredibly, I mean, it's beyond cynical, right?
Yes, it is.
A view of I'm just going to make up a story out of whole cloth that is so sensational, so outrageous that it will get attention. And I don't have any problems just literally lying, making things up, false statements, so that I can redirect attention of the media to something that I want to be talking about rather than the things that I don't want to be talking about. And we're getting into now, with Donald Trump, J.D. Vance as well, the sort of eradication of all truth and the elimination of fact, which just, in their mind, doesn't matter. It's the message that matters. It's not the facts that matter. And if we can't agree on the facts, how are we ever going to be able to figure out ways to solve our problems if we think that the facts are totally different? We can't agree on what the problems are. How can we solve them? And it's I am very frustrated that this immigration issue, as you point out, is D.C. is the same, but right now it's really with immigration. The cynicism of Donald Trump to submarine a very robust border security bill that would have addressed, significantly addressed the problems that we are having at the border, because he wants there to be chaos because it helps his political campaign. That is, to me, just so awfully cynical and really below board that it's so frustrating that our purported leaders would rather continue ongoing problems than solve them purely for their own political benefit. And we have to get back to a world in which we are trying to solve problems. And that is what the job of elected officials is, whether you're Democrat or Republican. It's very important to do that, and that's effectively what we're responsible for doing. And if there are people who are intentionally undermining that objective just for power or for political purposes, then our system is not going to work.
Do you think we hold any responsibility as Democrats? Should we accept any responsibility as Democrats for Donald Trump? I mean, I remember right after the election, First of all, I told everybody in my family nobody would vote for this man. So when he got elected, the only good thing I can say is they don't ask me for my political opinion anymore. But I went to a rally and I heard a woman stand up and say, as Democrats, we have nothing to apologize for, when he got elected. And it struck me as, you know, strange, because I felt, yes, we did have something to feel responsible for, and that's that he got elected. I felt like if we were doing our job as Democrats, that you know, people would have stood up for us. Is there something that we should be doing as Democrats that you can think of that we're not doing that has led the country to? Because I think people want chaos. They think there are a lot of people that vote for this man. I mean, how many people stand up there, Congressman, and say that they don't, you know, oh, we don't like the way he talks. Oh, yeah, he's horrible with women. Oh, yeah, but we're still going to vote for him. I think they're voting for him because they're dissatisfied with the direction the country has taken. Do you feel any of that from New Yorkers?
I agree. And I think that rather than apologize or feel responsible for it, I think we have to stop discarding it and disregarding it. And we have to recognize that one way or another, rightly or wrongly, Donald Trump has tapped into something in a lot of Americans.
Yeah.
Who feel like the country has either our government or our economy has left them behind, that they don't feel like their people are focusing on their problems and their issues. And Donald Trump's populism has, I think, in some fine ways, but in a lot of sort of devious and cynical ways, has fomented this anger that's inside a lot of people. And rather than disregard them as, you know, cult figures or cult followers or they're voting against their own self-interest, we have to do a much better job as Democrats of explaining to them, to people in rural America, listen, our policies, Democratic policies across the board, are the ones that are designed to help you. Donald Trump's tax cuts help only the super uber wealthy, and they hurt you. But you know, when you look at Kamala Harris's tax plan, that is going to reduce taxes on anyone under $400,000 of income. Donald Trump's is going to increase those taxes. Donald Trump's policies are always favoring the wealthy and big corporations. Our policies are designed to help lift everybody up. And we're trying to build out education. We're trying to provide a baseline safety net of healthcare, which is a human right, so that we're trying to reduce prescription drug prices, which we have done. We're trying to provide affordable child care so people don't have to choose between going to work and taking care of their child. We're trying to make sure that every child in America can eat, regardless of whether or not their parents can afford it. These are basic rights that all Americans should have, but only Democrats are the ones advocating for them. And so we have to do a better job of communicating that far more broadly than what we have done before.
Yeah, I think we do. And I just came back. I went to Nebraska a couple of months ago to testify before the Senate out there on a resolution for D.C. statehood. And, you know, I had a friend that told me when Trump was first elected that my problem was I lived in this bubble of the District of Columbia. And, you know, so I didn't understand how America felt. And I got to tell you, from when I went out to Nebraska, I came back. These are not the same people that live in the District of Columbia. And I think we do need to reach out more to those people. And we have to stop talking down to America. I think that's our Achilles heel, Congressman. I think that we tend to do that. We tend to make people without college educations and blue-collar workers and people like that feel like they're less than they used to be. You know, I don't understand. I'm a former Teamster. And I don't understand how my union, for the first time, sent the president of the union to speak at the RNC, along with Hulk Hogan and some of the other ridiculous people they had out there, and how this man who's never worked a day in his life and is a billionaire has convinced working class people that he feels their pain. He how does he even know their pain? It's a, don't get me started. I'm sorry. I'm getting off track here.
No, but the union thing, the union point is a really, really important one. And there are a growing number of union members who support Donald Trump. And if you were just simply to look at Donald Trump's policies towards unions, union membership, NLRB, minimum wage, fair wage, workplace protections, retirement age, Social Security, and you look at Kamala Harris's, every single union member benefits so much more from Kamala Harris's policies towards unions, towards labor than Donald Trump. But he has tapped into a feeling, and so people are drawn to that feeling that he does seem to recognize that in them, but he does not tap into any solutions. And so what we have are the solutions, and we have to recognize that there is that feeling and do a much better job of talking to union members and talking to anyone, whether college educated or not, that we are there for you. Our policies are designed to help you, and we understand you're not getting the benefit of them enough, and that's what we're focused on doing.
Well, how do we get that message out more? Because the New York Times just did a poll that showed that our candidate, Kamala Harris, is behind in Georgia, Arizona, and North Carolina. Even in Arizona, where we're getting beat to death on the immigration on our immigration policies, where, as you've already pointed out, Trump shot down that bill that would have changed things at the border, and then President Biden stepped in, and now border crossings are the lowest they've been since Trump was in office. They're lower than they were when Trump was in office, but still we're taking it on the chin for that. So what do you think that we need to do in these states to get that message out that we're the people out there trying to help you, not him? If you could give one piece of advice to the campaign.
Well, I think the campaign is doing it. I think they're doing a very good job. I think part of the challenge is that, the vice president has not had a long runway to get her message out, get her policy views out. I think there's understandably sort of uncertainty about where she is. As she is doing that, especially on her economic policy, her favorability is rising significantly. The strength of the polling on how she compares to Trump and on the economy is getting better and better for her. So part of this is just getting out there as much as possible. I think she's terrific on her feet as a former prosecutor, and I hope that she will do a lot more unscripted events, get out there and react. And she's so empathetic and compassionate, and then also firm and strong, that she will be a great leader for us. And I think part of the next 6 weeks is really just making sure that as many people as possible see that. And we're on the right track. I do feel good about that.
Well, I think you're right, too. I think you're right about that, and I hope she does. I don't agree with the second debate. I don't know how you feel about it, but I feel like this man couldn't say anything dumber than they're eating our cats and dogs, so why chance it? You know, why not just, you know, that's one of the first things I learned from my grandmother. If it ain't broke, don't fix it. And it seems right now that it's not broke. So I worry about us trying to fix it. But we're starting to run out of time. So I can't let you leave without asking you this, because I know you sit on the committee that deals with the District of Columbia. And I want to start by thanking you for being a co-sponsor of our statehood bill. You know how important statehood is to District of Columbia. It's passed twice in the House. We can't get it through the Senate because, as you know, we have cloture, and it's been completely a partisan thing, which statehood always is. Statehood's always about the control of Congress. And so it's been a partisan thing. Democrats overwhelmingly support it. We have every Democrat in the United States Senate, with the exception of two that are co-sponsors of the bill. But we can't get any Republicans on the bill. So if we take control of the House again, I'm sure we'll pass the bill. But in the Senate, it's going to be a long haul if we have to overcome cloture. Our only other alternative is to suspend the rule, to suspend the filibuster. Now, you're a lawyer with a lot of experience. You think that there's any viability in doing this? We've suspended it for funding bills. Can't we? You think there's any way we can suspend it for what I consider the most basic right of citizenship?
Well, I think there's a strong push to suspend the filibuster for our fundamental constitutional rights, or issues that pertain to the fundamental constitutional rights. The risk, of course, is that's a slippery slope. That's a subjective determination. It probably is going to be the pathway towards the end of the filibuster altogether. Well, certainly that's what happened with the judges. That's where it went. So, I mean, that's, I think, the concern. But the flip side of it is it's true not only with statehood and right to citizenship and the right to vote. It's true with abortion access. It's true with the right to vote. It's true with so many different fundamental issues that just are allow for minority rule. And we already have a situation where, you know, we know that Kamala Harris is going to win the national vote. Right. But that doesn't matter. It's just the Electoral College. So, you know, we're in a situation where we now accept the fact that a presidential candidate who loses the popular vote can still win the presidency, and somehow that's okay. We're the only nation in the world where that happens. And so the consistent effort by Republicans to perpetuate minority rule because their policies are unpopular, and they want to suppress the vote and they want to limit the majority rule is really anti-democratic. And so it's something that we have to keep fighting against and not give up.
Yeah, it's absolutely crazy, is it not, that you can win 11 states. You can lose 39 states. You can win if you won what we call the Sacred 11, right? New Jersey, New York, Michigan, Wisconsin, all the populated states, Virginia, Texas, California. You can win and you can lose all the other states. It's really crazy. And I think that, I can see the Electoral College coming under fire in the next several years from people. But let me ask you, Congressman, we're almost out of time, so is there anything that you want to add, anything you want to add about bump stocks or guns or anything else that I haven't asked you?
Well, we could obviously speak all day on so many of these issues, Senator. I would just say on the Electoral College, there is a movement, which is the National Popular Vote Compact, where when enough states pass a law that says, when 270 electoral votes are decided by the national vote, enough states have to pass a law saying that they will allocate their electoral votes to according to the national popular vote, not according to their state vote. And if we can get to 270, then that will become how the Electoral College is actually decided. I think it's over 200 electoral votes have been passed, and so that's the possibility of doing it without a constitutional amendment. So
I will leave you with that, because I think that's a way of bolstering our democracy, and doesn't require a constitutional amendment.
Well, on that note, that's a great note to end on. Representative Dan Goldman from New York's 10th, thanks so much for being with me today. We always leave us our play our show out with a song, and we dedicate it to our guests. This is Alicia Keys talking about this city that I know Representative Goldman loves and I love too, and that's New York. We'll see you all next week. Thanks again, Representative. And let's get Kamala Harris elected, huh?
Sounds good. Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, thanks again. We'll see you next week, folks. Thanks.
Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote.